Chapter 8. It had come to her in the small hours, the Chelsea house. Carl has bought and sold property compulsively during their marriage, and because this one had been under constant renovation, they hadn't actually stayed there yet. In the chaos of the previous day, she had almost forgotten its existence, but she needs a base while this is sorted out, and whatever state it's in, it will be better than the Tower Primavera. The sudden recollection of it at 2:14 a.m. had made her almost giddy with relief. She has no key, but if the builders are still working there, they will let her in, and if they aren't, she will break in. No policeman in the world is going to object to a homeowner breaking into their own house. Nisha lies awake, planning her next move. Install herself in the house, get a lawyer, recover her bag, then kick Carl's butt. It is this last thought that consoles her into a fitful sleep until 7, when she showers, climbs into yesterday's clothes, and heads down to the dining area to eat the all-inclusive breakfast.
What do you mean there's no a la carte?
Nisha stares at the server, who blinks at her and turns away. There are a million reasons why Nisha hasn't eaten a buffet breakfast in 2 decades. The food is always the cheapest, greasy eggs sitting under hot lights, pallid sausages sliding in metal trays, strangers lean over the stainless steel containers, shedding hair or skin cells as they loom. It has always been her worst nightmare. Until she was hungry. This is not Nisha's habitual hunger, low-grade, ever-present, but a new variety that leaves her shaky and a little faint, unable to think about anything but food. She stands in the busy breakfast room, a gaudy yellow conference hall where the chairs are covered with plastic and the walls bear translations for good morning in a dozen different languages. Despite her revulsion, her stomach growls and claws like an animal about to loose itself. She takes 2 tomatoes, something that describes itself as scrambled egg, and 2 hash browns. She adds a banana, at least nobody can get into those, and places some sealed rectangles of cheese in her pocket. A man to her right gives her a pointed look, and she glares at him until he colours slightly and turns away. She carries her plate to the furthest point of the room, sits, and studies one of the free newspapers, though she barely takes anything in. While she eats, she goes over and over the plan in her head. Once she has secured her base, she will need money. She will have to borrow some just till a lawyer comes through. She wonders who she might possibly be able to borrow money from. Pretty much all her friends these days, she recalls with a creeping sense of dismay, are Carl's friends. She thinks briefly about Juliana, but they have not spoken in more than 15 years, and Juliana never had any money anyway. The man Magda had spoken to, the one who was supposed to provide her with insurance, has disappeared. As she sips her coffee, she starts to feel a rising sense of panic. How has she ended up here? She forces herself to close her eyes and breathe deeply. She thinks of Carl's bloated, self-satisfied face. He's probably eating his eggs Benedict in the suite right now. She thinks of how it will feel to turn the tables on him. She has survived worse, she tells herself, murmuring under her breath. She will survive this. When she opens them again, a bored-looking kitchen worker is standing by the table.
You need to clear your tray into the bins when you're finished.
Nisha stares at the woman for a full 3 seconds, some furious internal struggle just visible in her features. She takes a long breath, then picks up the tray and walks, stiff-backed, past the woman to the bins. Using the last of her loose change, Nisha catches a bus and sits near the front, refusing to acknowledge the scattering of passengers around her. She gets off by Chelsea Bridge and walks the 10 minutes to the little square. It seems acceptable, white stucco buildings, pretty boutiques, and decent coffee shops. A florist sells exquisite arrangements of blue hydrangeas, and she pictures a display of them on a dining table once she's in, and plans what she will book at the nearby beauty salon. Right now, she would kill for a massage. But it's fine. She will survive here for the foreseeable. She finally enters the little square, quietly satisfied at the evident peace of it. The sight of the Filipina nanny walking past with well-dressed children, the elderly woman with her dachshund. This, at least, is a place that understands how things are done, a million miles from the grease and noise and bustle of the hotel. And there it is, number 57. She stops in front of the gate and looks up, vaguely recalling its frontage from the real estate agent details. It's a fairly modest house by Carl's standards, but he had chosen it for the location, and she remembers nodding and smiling and saying it was lovely, as she did with all his property purchases. He is a light sleeper and insists on living on roads where there is no through traffic or, preferably, surrounded by acres of their own land. The building work's finished, she thinks pleased, noting the neutral blinds, the carefully tended roses around the front garden. She is just wondering if she can remember the name of the construction firm, Barrington, Ballingham, when the front door of her house opens and a woman steps out. The interior designer, Nisha thinks, and steps forward, but almost immediately the woman shepherds out two small children. She looks up when she sees Nisha standing at the gate and half waits. The two women stare at each other for a moment, blank, confused smiles on their faces. The woman breaks first.
"Can I help you?"
she says, when Nisha doesn't move. She is whippet thin, her hair a straight curtain of natural hazel and blonde, clad in the expensive casual wear of the wealthy, non-working mother. Nisha is taken aback by her brazenness.
You can tell me what you're doing in my house?
The woman blinks, half laughs.
This is my house?
It is not. We bought this house 3 years ago. I have the documents to prove it.
The woman stiffens. We bought it 4 months ago. I also have the solicitor's emails to prove it.
They stare at each other. The children gaze wide-eyed, then look up at their mother.
This is absurd, says the woman, moving them behind her, as if she is dealing with a crazy person. I'm afraid you must have the wrong address. Please leave us alone.
Number 57, says Nisha. That's my house.
It's not your house.
It is. Both women half laugh without humour, as if aware of the absurdity of the conversation. Nisha sees the woman take in her cheap clothes, the low-quality shoes, and she observes a flicker pass across her face, as if Nisha might be dangerous, perhaps recently released from a mental facility.
"Who are you?" says the woman, her voice tense.
"My name is Nisha Cantor."
"Oh!" says the woman, suddenly relieved. "Cantor, yes, you are the people we bought it from."
But we haven't sold it," says Nisha. "He would have needed my signature, he would..." She realizes with a jolt what Carl has done. Oh God. The street starts to buck and spin around her.
Are you okay?
The woman's demeanor has softened slightly. She steps forward and makes to touch Nisha's arm. Nisha immediately snaps it away. She does not like to be touched at the best of times, least of all by someone showing visible sympathy.
4 months ago, she shakes her head. Of course. Look, I think you'd better speak to your solicitor, but this house is very definitely ours. I have the solicitor's and land registry papers to prove it. I can get them from inside if you...
Oh, no, I believe you, Nisha says. She feels winded. He must have been planning this for months. She lets out a small sound that might have been a groan and tries to steady herself before she pushes herself upright.
Are you okay? Would you like me to...
She turns before the woman can say anything else and sets off at a brisk walk back towards the bus stop, feeling three pairs of eyes burn into her until she is out of sight.
Mom, why are you calling so early? And why are you calling collect?
I knew you'd be up, darling. I know you're a night owl. How are you doing?
Fine.
She winces. Fine, in teenager speak, can cover anything from ecstatic to just been scrolling through a dozen YouTube videos about the best way to kill myself.
How was your day?
Fine.
She hesitates, but this cannot wait.
Baby, I have a little favor to ask.
She can hear a screen burbling in the background. He is probably playing one of those online games that involve wearing headphones and screeching at distant teammates.
I need you to wire me some money.
What?
He says it twice, clearly perplexed.
I want to buy Daddy a birthday present, and I don't want him to see it come out of the joint account, she says smoothly. You know how he is about watching all the financial stuff. Can you use your card?
He sounds distracted. She hears the sound of distant explosions followed by gunfire.
I
I had my bag stolen yesterday. I've lost my phone and all my cards.
Oh no, which bag? Says Ray, his attention suddenly drawn from the game. Not the Bottega Veneta.
No, just an old one. I'm not sure you even know it.
Oh, cool. Well, how do I do that? I don't know how to wire money. Sasha, shooter, on your left.
She talks him through the process and he does it online as they speak. He seems to find the idea of wiring her some money almost akin to an adventure, and she realizes with a faint sense of guilt that they have so seldom asked him to do anything practical. He arranges to wire $500, the most she feels she can ask for without prompting suspicion.
What are you going to buy?
It takes her a second.
For Daddy, I don't know. I'm looking at options.
No, what bag? To replace yours.
His voice lowers. The new autumn-winter YSL is cute, mid-sized crossbody with kind of diagonal cushioning. It's in the news Vogue, page 46. You'd rock that, Mom. She smiles, delighted at his sudden animation.
I'll take a look, sweetheart. It sounds fabulous. Thank you. And I'll pay you back as soon as I've got everything straight this end.
There is a short silence.
So, when are you coming home?
Soon, darling, soon.
Sasha's leaving on the 8th. I can't be here once he's gone. He's the only good one left. Everyone else is just, I know. I'll fix it. I promise. I love you.
He heads back to his game and she ends the call and breathes a long sigh of relief. That's three more nights taken care of and her food. It will buy her time to breathe at least. She sits on the bed and feels the softness that always envelops her when she talks to Ray gradually harden as she considers her day. Right. She'll brush her teeth in the hideous bathroom. Next stop, the gym to see whether her bag has been returned. And then a damn good lawyer.
Nobody's handed in any bags.
It has taken Nisha 52 minutes to walk here. She's cross and sweaty. The jacket is making her neck itch, and there is definitely something off about the way this girl is talking to her.
Well, what are you going to do about it? There's a Chanel jacket and Christian Louboutin shoes in that bag. The bag itself is Marc Jacobs, for God's sake.
The girl gives her the kind of pleasantly blank look that says, boy, am I going to talk shit about you as soon as you're out of here? She raises a smile that isn't a smile.
I'm so sorry, madam, but there are signs on the wall saying we cannot be liable for items that go missing in the changing rooms. We do advise all clients to lock their lockers and keep an eye on their belongings.
Her peculiar patronizing intonation makes Nisha want to hurl herself over the counter fists first.
I'll be happy to put it in the incident book, the girl adds.
Incident book?
Well, it's usually for minor injuries, but I'm happy to put it in there so that if and when your bag is returned, whoever is staffing reception is aware that it belongs to you. If you'd like to give me your details, I'll make sure someone contacts you in the event of it reappearing.
The way she says reappearing makes it clear to Nisha that she doesn't expect it to reappear anytime soon.
Well, you have been immensely helpful. She says, I'll be in touch, maybe to get a recommendation for whoever is in charge of your customer service training.
She sweeps out, thanking God that she hadn't bothered to bring the other bag with her. She picks up Ray's money from the wire service, buys a cheap pay-as-you-go phone from a pawn shop, some top-up vouchers from the supermarket, and at 3 p.m. she uses the hotel Wi-Fi to call Leonie Whitman. After a modicum of small talk and fake admiration for her latest Instagram posts, Leonie is so thirsty for attention, like a woman with her ass should be posing in a bikini, even if it is on her husband's yacht. Nisha asks her if she can recommend a good divorce lawyer.
It's my assistant, she says, lowering her voice. She's in a dreadful situation, and I'd like to help if I can. She's such a sweet woman, and I want to protect her.
Oh, you're so kind to your staff, says Leonie. I couldn't bear Marie when her husband left. She was so moody and I kept finding her weeping in closets. Honestly, I was that close to firing her. It just affected the whole mood of the house.
Well, you know, a good assistant is worth looking after.
Nisha smiles, thinking guiltily of Magda. She jots down the number and ends the call as swiftly as she can. She doesn't think she heard anything in Leonie's voice that suggested Angeline Mercer had told her what was going on. But Leonie is a one-woman broadcasting service, and she needs to act quickly. Saul Lowenstein, esteemed New York divorce lawyer, takes the call.
She suspected he might, despite it being a weekend, given her name. He is unctuous, charming on the phone, his mellifluous, confidential tone that of someone who has listened to a wealth of furious soon-to-be ex-wives.
"And how can I help you, Mrs. Cantor?"
She explains the situation in as bald and emotionless a manner as she can manage, but even as she does, hearing the words out loud, she feels an unexpected prickling behind her eyes, the fury and the unfairness of it catching like a plumb stone in her throat. "Take your time, take your time," he says gently, and even this makes her furious. The fact that Carl has turned her into one of those women, the women who wail that their husband has left them, and how can he do this to her, blah, blah, blah. "But he can't do this to me," she finishes. "I mean, I'm pretty sure he can't do this to me. We were married for almost 2 decades. He can't just shut me out without a dollar. I mean, I'm his wife." He asks the extent of their assets, and she tells him what she can remember. The duplex in New York, the house in Los Angeles, the estate in the Hamptons, the yacht, the cars, the private jet, the office buildings. She is not sure what his business is worth, or even what exactly he does, but she explains it as best she can. Saul Lowenstein takes a moment before he speaks. He speaks reassuringly, as if this is all just a minor inconvenience that can be sorted. The prospect of his fee for such a case, she thinks, eases the most reticent of minds. "Right, well, the first thing we can do to help your immediate situation is send a letter demanding access to the joint account. Luckily for you, Mrs. Cantor, London's divorce laws are some of the most equitable in the world. You will get, if not half, then a very decent proportion of his earnings for the last 18 years. Nisha drops her face into her hand. "It is such a relief to talk to you, Mr. Lowenstein. You have no idea how stressful this has been."
"I'm sure, and then we need to find you a base while we sort this unfortunate business out. Now, do you own any property in England?"
"We did," she says. "He appears to have sold it." "Ah, a pity. Most judges are reluctant to turn a woman out of a marital home." She can hear him scribbling notes as he speaks, the rude blare of a New York siren somewhere in the background. It makes her oddly homesick.
"Now, the divorce papers you say your husband's security man gave you, can you read the first page to me?"
She does as he says and sits, almost in a dream, while he digests it. As he takes notes, she thinks about what she will do once this is sorted. She will fetch Ray. She might even bring him back to stay in London for a bit. She has no desire to head back to the US and all those rubberneckers who, when the news gets out, will suddenly find an excuse to call her just to be able to report back the gossip to each other. No, she and Ray will get a place here while they work out how to proceed.
"Mrs. Cantor?"
She is pulled back from her reverie.
"These are the papers he handed you?"
"Yes," she says. "I don't have any other sets of divorce papers." He sighs.
"These appear to be American divorce papers. He must have drawn them up in the US. Unfortunately, American divorce law is quite different."
"Meaning what?"
"It is going to be difficult to challenge your access to the bank accounts. You don't seem to have enough links to the UK to employ Part 3 of the Matrimonial Causes Act 1984, as I might otherwise have suggested. Transatlantic enforcement of divorce rulings is notoriously tricky. We could potentially try for a court order, but it cannot be enforced, especially if he decides to fly back to the United States. We can send him a legal letter, but..."
Carl has never paid any attention to a legal letter in his life. "You don't understand, Mr. Lowenstein. Carl does not believe rules apply to him. I have watched him at close quarters for 20 years, and he does what he wants, always. It's like a point of pride for him. He cannot ever be seen to lose."
Saul Lowenstein lets out a heavy sigh. "Then I'm afraid this does not bode well. I see a lot of high net worth clients, Mrs. Cantor. And it usually goes like this. The husband, because I'm afraid it usually is the husband, divests himself of all assets into offshore holdings in the Caymans or Liechtenstein, and the wife is left trying to claim half of something that no longer officially exists while chasing him around the globe. And there is the other problem."
"What?" says Nisha, her head spinning. "What other problem?"
"Well, without any money, Mrs. Cantor, you cannot pay me."
Nisha freezes. "I'm a very wealthy woman. You'll get your money."
"I can only operate on cases at this level with a sizable cash retainer."
But I haven't got anything right now. He shut everything down. I told you.
I'm very sorry, Mrs. Cantor. I really can't do anything without a retainer. If you could sort things out at that end, I'd be very happy to take on your case. Beyond that, I'm afraid there's little I can do at this time. I'm not sure of any lawyers worth their salt who could.
She is speechless. She thinks, for one horrific moment, that she might burst into tears. He waits a few seconds before he breaks the silence.
It's not an unusual modus operandi among those of your income bracket, Mrs. Cantor. He thinks I'm going to screw her, grind her down, until she's just glad to agree to anything. And that appears to be what's happening here. You could, if you're in desperate need, approach the police, perhaps, or the American Embassy.
I don't want the police involved.
She drops her head into her hand.
I don't understand, she whispers. I don't understand why he's done this.
He sighs, then says, his voice low and confidential. In my experience, it's worth looking at the assistant.
His assistant? She says, her skin prickling. But
young? Pretty?
She thinks of Charlotte with her glowing skin and immaculate, sleeked back ponytail, her bland smile whenever Nisha walked into the office.
The assistant knows the husband's every need, every want, and every movement. They also know where the money goes. I'm very sorry to say, Mrs. Cantor, but in the vast majority of cases, that's where you'll find your explanation. I hope very much that you're able to sort this out, and of course I'm always here for you.
If I can get a retainer,
she says. If you can get a retainer.
He ends the call abruptly, as someone who charges $800 an hour but isn't getting paid for this particular communication is wont to do. And Nisha is left sitting on the flammable bedspread, breathing heavily into the silence.
Chapter 9. Sam arrives home at 3:30 p.m., her headache resolutely refusing to lift. The dog greets her with the slightly pained and bug-eyed demeanor of a creature who desperately needs to empty his bladder. As she clips the lead to Kevin's collar, without even removing her coat, she hears the television in the living room and feels a flash of irritation. Would it really be so hard for him just to get up and walk the dog for 15 minutes? Would it? God knows he does nothing else to help around the house these days.
Has Kevin been out?
She says carefully, although she knows the answer.
Oh,
Phil says, turning to look at her like the dog's needs are a surprise.
No.
She waits for a moment.
How's Andrea?
He says.
On the mend, please God.
He sighs heavily, as if Andrea's woes merely add to his own burden, and gives her a small, unconvincing smile before turning back to the television. Sometimes this smile makes her sad. Today, it makes her want to scream.
I'll take Kevin, shall I?
She says when his gaze returns to the television.
Sure,
he says, as if that were the only sensible option.
You've got your coat on.
She leaves the house with a low hum of rage ringing in her ears.
You shouldn't leave him alone so much, her mother had told her the previous week. I mean, it's hard for a man not being the main breadwinner. He's bound to feel sorry for himself.
Men of that age are surprisingly fragile, their GP had said. I do believe women are the much tougher of the species. He had said it like he expected her to take it as a compliment.
You're a bit moody these days, Mum, her daughter had said. Shouldn't you think about taking HRT or something?
No, I'm not tougher, I'm not moodier, she wanted to yell at them. I'm just bloody tired, but if I give up and lie on the sofa all day, the whole damn thing will fall apart at the seams.
She scolds Kevin, who dawdles outside the neighbour's house, sniffing endlessly at the base of their privet. Then she feels guilty because none of this is poor Kevin's fault, crouches down and throws her arms around his fat neck, whispering,
Sorry, darling, I'm so sorry,
until she looks up and sees Jed from number 72 staring at her like she's finally lost her marbles. She walks all the way to the canal because she cannot think what to do if she's at home, ignoring the couples who walk arm in arm, scowling at the cyclists who force her onto the side of the path. Kat is working this afternoon. She seems to have a portfolio of part-time jobs. Barista, delivery girl, waitress.
It's making the gig economy work for you, Mum. You don't want to be dependent on just one job. And Sam knows that if she stays at home, she will either have to sit with Phil in the dead-aired, enervating living room or start one of the 148 tasks that need doing in the house that everyone else seems to believe are her responsibility. If she does this, she will be seething, her rage barely suppressed, within minutes. And then she will hate herself for it, because depression is no one's fault. As she has never had it, she reminds herself, she cannot fully understand the compulsion to do nothing. Or perhaps the lack of compulsion to do anything? Either way, at least if she's walking Kevin, she can feel like she's done something and boosted her step count while she's at it. She recalls a philosophy teacher asking her class, "How many of the decisions you make each day are because you actually want to do something, and how many are to avoid the consequences of not doing it?" Nearly everything she does these days is just to stop something else happening. If she doesn't keep her steps up, she will get fat. If she doesn't walk the dog, he will be in the hall. Sometimes Sam feels she has been so conditioned to be useful every minute of every day that there is almost nothing she does in which she is not simultaneously keeping a subconscious tally. Do men hear this constant inner voice, telling them constantly to strive, to be better, to be productive, to be useful? Even when Phil was happier, he was mostly oblivious to the towel rail that had half come out of the bathroom wall, the pile of socks that needed sorting on the washing machine, the crumbs on the floor, the fridge that really needed its shelves wiped before they all died of penicillin poisoning. She finds herself wondering absently if Joel does things. She pictures him changing a toilet roll without being asked, his expression cheery. No hint of, "I changed the toilet roll for you, babe," on his lips, like some kind of fantasy man. And then she thinks of dancing with him the previous night, the heat of his hands on her waist, and flushes with guilty pleasure. "He's sweet on you," Marina had said, and she finds herself mentally counting all the nice things he has said to her before deciding she's being ridiculous and pushes the thought of him away. She pulls Kevin out of the path of another rampaging cyclist who rings his bell and swears as he whooshes past. She wants to yell at him, but she once read a newspaper story about a woman who was pushed into the canal after protesting to a cyclist, so she stays quiet. She remembers, with a jolt, she hasn't taken that kit bag back to the fancy gym. Will the owner have alerted the police about the missing designer clothes? She thinks about the list of things she has to get through in the rest of her day. Pick up her father's prescription and drop it round to her parents, stopping for a cup of tea so they don't complain that they never see her, sort out the pile of washing on the upstairs landing, defrost the freezer because the door has stopped closing, go through the pile of bills on the side that she has put off all week. She checks her watch. She'll take the bag back before work on Monday. Another job to squeeze into her already packed day. Then she thinks about Andrea, who has nothing in her day except time in which to contemplate the abyss she has been staring into for months. And then she feels guilty for complaining about anything. "I need a holiday," she thinks, and that thought makes her think of the camper van. She puts her head down and trudges towards home. The camper van. Sam lets out an involuntary sigh every time she sees it, staring at the giant yellow sunflower painted on its side. Phil had bought it 2 years ago from a friend at work, back when he was still in work, and had arrived home full of enthusiasm and visions of their future trips together. "It just needs a bit of TLC, I'll respray it, replace the bumper, and update the interior. The engine's in pretty good shape. It's always the roof on these things that you need to watch. Water seepage," he had added knowledgeably, as if he had any more experience of a camper van than a week-long family holiday in Tenby when he was 10 years old. She had been quietly furious at first. How could he splurge £3,000 of their savings without consulting her? But gradually she had allowed herself to be carried along by the picture he painted of holidays around the South Coast. Maybe even the continent. Wouldn't that be great, Sammy? Lying out in the south of France, sleeping under the stars. He had hugged her to him, murmuring into her ear. Sam had remembered a holiday in the south of France where being bitten by mosquitoes and the horror of the pit-like campsite toilet you had to squat over had reduced them to hysterical laughter. They were good at adventures, even the ones that involved having to wash your shoelaces after you'd been to the bathroom. Phil had serviced the engine, got it through the MOT, and removed the rear bumper, ready to find a replacement on his online auction site. But then his father had received his diagnosis, and there was no time to do anything, aside from work, but look after Rich and Nancy.
3 months after the awful toxic mix of chemotherapy and suppressed emotion, Phil had been made redundant, and the camper van had apparently been forgotten.
"Why don't you spend some time this afternoon working on the van?"
she would suggest every few weeks, hoping that the mixture of practical problem-solving and fresh air would make him feel more himself. And at first he would nod and say sure, definitely, if he had time, but as the weeks passed he would look hunted if she mentioned it. And after a while it was easier never to mention it at all. Now the van sits, its innards 3/4 removed, its bumper still missing, silently rusting in their driveway until it's taxed again, its unmoving bulk a rebuke to her dreams of holidays and a better way of living, and also to the idea that they might be able to park the car somewhere other than 3 streets away from their own house. Kevin sniffs its rear tire, which is as deflated as she feels, then abruptly cocks his leg, letting out a thin stream of urine against it. She has a sudden urge to do the same thing, just lowering her pants and cocking her leg against the wheel, a bald expression of disgust at the whole damn thing. She pictures the neighbours, appalled, staring out of their windows and conferring as she crouches, and smiles. And as she tells Kevin he is a good dog, a very good dog, and makes her way inside, she realises this is the first thing that has made her laugh all day.
"How was the pub?"
Phil has raised himself to a sitting position on the sofa. Kevin bounds up to him, giddy and delighted to see the man he hasn't seen for a whole 45 minutes, completely free of resentment for his stretched bladder. Phil fondles the dog's ears.
"The pub? Oh, fine. It was fine."
He looks at her for a moment, and briefly, something sad and self-aware passes across his face.
"Sorry I didn't make it. I was just really tired and..."
His voice tells away.
"I know.
I'm sorry," he says again, quietly looking down. And Sam, parking her mental list of jobs, sits down beside him, takes his hand and lets her head rest, just for a while, on his shoulder. Chapter 10. Nisha has located 2 more White Horse pubs, walking miles through insalubrious London streets in the awful shoes, in both cases to be told no, they had no idea about any stolen shoes, and none of the bar staff at the one pub with CCTV knew how to work the playback.
"You can come back when the manager's here."
The girl had shrugged in a way that told her he was likely to be even less interested than she was. Nisha had barely slept these 2 nights, her thoughts twisting and congealing as she considers what Carl has done to her, her fury mounting, along with her determination to reclaim what is hers. She was at the breakfast buffet when it opened at 6:30 a.m., her hair damp and scraped into a ponytail, and downed 2 swift coffees, ignoring the growling of her stomach. She finally slows her pace as the Bentley Hotel comes into view. She sees the top-hatted doorman greeting a weary traveller, whose suitcases are being unloaded from a taxi, and wonders briefly whether Frederick will have briefed him not to let her in. She doesn't care, she tells herself. She will walk straight past him, sit down in the lobby, and this time she will refuse to move. She straightens the awful jacket and checks her watch. 7:37. Carl will be dressed by now, up in the suite, sitting at his desk and checking the financial pages while waiting for his coffee. Black, 2 sugars. Who is bringing him that coffee? She thinks suddenly. Is it Charlotte? Nisha's favourite black silk dressing gown draped around her body, a smile of post-coital satisfaction on that tight, young, duplicitous face. She pauses, her jaw setting, and runs through what she plans to say to him. "You can have your divorce, Carl. I just want what's mine. I want simply what you owe me." She will do it with dignity, with pride. Or maybe she will just kick him in the nuts. She takes a deep breath, walks 2 steps towards the door, and it is then she spies Ari standing a short distance from the doorman, his earpiece in, his mouth barely moving as he conducts some discreet conversation with one of his men. Ari, whom she once watched knock a man to the ground with a single swift jab to the neck. That can only mean one thing, that they half expect her to try to come back. Before he can see her, she ducks into the side alley that runs alongside the hotel, her heart pounding in her chest. Outside a door, halfway down, 2 kitchen workers are sitting on a step, smoking and drinking coffee. She stands close to them and lights a cigarette, turning her back to the road and trying not to breathe in the scent of urine and stale food.
She might get past the doorman, but she will not get past Ari. And there is somehow a greater humiliation involved in being blocked and removed by the man who had been paid for the last decade to protect her. She takes short, jittery drags on the cigarette while she considers her options, oblivious to the two men who glance at her with incurious eyes, then continue their conversation. A woman in an anorak with a bowed head walks past and steps into the doorway beside them, and then another, talking animatedly in a foreign language on her cell phone. A third, with braided hair and a long padded coat, stops in front of her.
You waiting to go in, darling?
Nisha looks up.
You don't want to go in smelling of ciggies. Frederick hates it here.
The woman pulls a spray from her handbag and before Nisha can protest, has blasted her with a cloud of cheap musk. Nisha screws up her eyes at the chemical smell and coughs. Tucking the spray back into her bag, the woman says,
Come on, you knew. Follow me.
Ari appears at the end of the alley, still looking the other way. Nisha makes a split-second decision and follows the woman into the back entrance of the hotel, walking along a narrow corridor, past hurrying waiters and someone pushing a large trolley of laundry. She leans back against the wall to let it pass, not wanting to touch any of the pile of germ-ridden sheets.
Your first time here?
Nisha nods, gazing behind her.
You got papers?
Papers?
National insurance number?
Nisha shakes her head. Don't worry, just say you're waiting on a replacement passport. They never ask too much.
How the hell else are they going to get anyone in on these wages?
She laughs dryly as if she has amused herself.
What's your name?
Nisha.
I'm Jasmine. Don't look so worried. They don't butt here. Come on. Let's get you kitted out and I'll take you over to Sandra. She's in charge of rotors.
Nisha finds herself in a room full of lockers, the air heavy with the leftover scents of food and overworked bodies.
Oi, Gilberto, take your trash out, man. I'm not paid to clear up after you lot as well as the guests.
A short, wiry man with nicotine-stained skin lurches in and picks up a polystyrene box from which a strong smell of fish seeps.
He's put me on doubles till Thursday. I swear, Jazz, I'm going to drop if this carries on.
Jasmine lets out a noise that sounds like a growl, and Gilberto leaves.
They're short-staffed at the moment, she says, opening a locker and putting her bag inside. It's been a nightmare. Since Brexit, the hotel has lost 40% of the staff. 40%.
Where are you from?
New York.
New York! Don't get many Americans here. Only the paying kind here.
What size are you?
8, 10? You're just a skinny little thing. She rifles through a pile of uniforms until she hauls out a black tunic and trousers.
We can wear our own stuff, but it's better to wear theirs. Some days I am too glad to leave the filth of this place behind and put my own clothes on again, you know. You don't want to take that shit home with you.
While she stands holding the folded pile of clothes, Jasmine peels her way unselfconsciously out of her elasticated dress, then hauls on a pair of black trousers and a tunic. She checks her appearance in the small mirror on the back of the door, then glances back at Nisha.
Come on, don't hang around. If we get upstairs by 2:15, there'll still be some breakfast.
She has no idea what she's doing, but staying close to Jasmine seems as good a plan as any right now. Nisha wriggles into the clothes. Thank God they smell of laundry service. Rams her stuff into an empty locker and follows Jasmine out and along the corridor. Nisha is not hungry, but in past days she has learned to eat when food is available, and she follows Jasmine mutely through the kitchens, watching as the younger woman greets her fellow workers.
What's going on, Nigel? Your mum out of hospital yet?
Glad to hear it, babe. Catch her. I watched that thing you told me. I nearly crapped myself, man. What business have you got making me watch horror? You know I don't have a man to protect me.
Jasmine laughs easily and pushes through doorways like she expects the world to fall away and clear her path. Nisha's mind races. She scans each room they enter, half waiting for Ari's figure to appear in front of her. But no, there are just these brisk, sometimes shuffling figures hurrying past, their faces etched with exhaustion, clearly focused on their jobs.
Here, what do you like? This is the one perk to starting early, Minette's pastries. Oh my God, I swear I was 7 stone till I started working here.
Jasmine hands her a plate and motions to a large tray on which a selection of pain au raisin, pain au chocolat and croissants are laid out. Nisha takes a pain au raisin and bites into it. In less than a nanosecond, she recognises that this is the best thing she has eaten in 3 days. Light and moist and delicately buttery, genuine French pâtisserie, still warm from the oven. For the first time in days, her brain stops spinning and she is lost in pleasure. good, right? Jasmine takes two and closes her eyes in bliss as she eats. My day from 5:30 is mental. I have to get my daughter up and dressed, make her pack lunch if it's a school day, then take her to my mum's in Peckham, then two more buses to come here, and I swear the only thing that keeps me going is the thought of these beauties waiting for me.
Oh, that's good, says Nisha through a mouthful of crumbs.
Minette's a goddamn genius.
Almost as good as you, Alex!
Over by the flaming stove, a lean man in chef's whites turns from his pans and nods at Jasmine.
You done?
Nisha nods.
Okay, let's go.
Jasmine wipes her mouth with a paper napkin and heads towards the door on the far side of the kitchen, pausing only to tell Nisha to straighten up your hair a bit, reaching over to tighten her ponytail before Nisha can stop her. Jasmine pushes through the double doors, walks briskly down a corridor and turns left into a small office.
We've got Nisha starting today, papers are in the post.
Oh, thank God, says a red-haired woman who is scrubbing names out on a rotor and doesn't look up. I've had four call in sick today. She need training.
Do you need training? Jasmine says to her.
Yes, says Nisha.
Can't be helped, says Red Hair.
Okay, Jazz, you'll have to show her the ropes. I'm going to up your rooms as you're two-handed. We've got 16 to do by two and two early check-ins. Here's the list. What's your name again?
Nisha is about to speak, then says, Anita.
Okay, Anita, come back and pick your badge up at 12. No illnesses, injuries or allergies? Fill this out when you return. We haven't got time for you to do it now.
I thought you said your name was Nisha.
The two women look at her. She has a sudden memory of Juliana and swallows.
I find Anita is easier for guests to pronounce.
Red Hair shrugs.
Anita it is. Okay, go get your stuff, Jazz. We're really low on bleach. Sorry about that. Elbow grease only wherever possible today. We'll need to save it for the bad stuff.
Elbow grease, the one thing they know we'll never be out of, Jasmine grumbles, and they head off towards the store cupboard.
10 minutes later, Nisha is following Jasmine as she pushes the housekeeping trolley along the carpeted corridor of the second floor. She feels electrified, visible, as if every guest who looks at her will guess what she's doing and know she's an imposter. She finds herself ducking her head as they pass, not wanting anyone to notice her.
What are you doing? Jasmine turns as the third guest walks by.
What do you mean?
We have to say good morning to all guests. It's company policy. You have to make them feel like they're part of the Bentley family. On the sixth and seventh floor, we have to say their names too.
She and Carl had occupied the suite on the seventh floor. Nisha was so used to staff knowing who she was that it had never occurred to her these greetings were part of any kind of policy. She mutters, good morning, as they pass the next guests, a German couple, who return a formal greeting and continue to the elevators. Jasmine brings the trolley to a halt outside room 39 and knocks twice, flicking through her clipboard as she waits for a response.
Housekeeping!
When nobody responds, she uses her key card, pushes the door, and waits until Nisha is behind her. The room is 1/10 the size of the suite. An unmade bed is in the centre, the sheets covered with crumbs and leftover food from the breakfast tray that is lying on the covers. A television blares the news. An empty wine bottle and two glasses stand on the side. Jasmine bustles round and turns off the television.
Okay, you start in the bathroom, I'll strip the bed. We normally have around 20 minutes to do these rooms or we'll get written up, and this morning we've got extra so you'll have to get a wiggle on.
Until then, Nisha realised afterwards, she hadn't really thought she was going to be asked to do anything. She had thought perhaps she could just don the uniform and disappear into the bowels of the building, work out how she could make her way into her suite. But now Jasmine is staring at her, one hand holding a blue cloth, her face slightly quizzical.
It ain't brain surgery, just clean it like your own bathroom, babe, but better.
Jasmine lets out a hearty laugh and dons her latex gloves before pulling off the coverlet briskly, like she knows what germs it might contain. Nisha stands in the bathroom, frozen. There are unidentified short hairs in the basin, the toilet seat is wet, and there are two damp towels on the floor, one bearing a pale brown mark that she hopes very much is makeup. She thinks about walking straight out, but this is her one opportunity to remain in the hotel, for the time being anyway. She takes two deep breaths, pulls on the gloves, and starts to clean the basin, trying not to look as she wipes. She is almost halfway through when Jasmine appears at the door.
Babe, You're going to have to switch it up. Have you done the book roll? Fold the corners when you put it on. Half-used ones go back on the trolley. Here, I'll do your bottles.
Jasmine sweeps all the half-empty mini bottles of shampoo and body lotion into a bin bag and disappears into the corridor. It is at that point that Nisha turns to the lavatory. It has yellow splashes dried onto the seat and a clear brown mark in the pan. She feels the remains of her breakfast rise ominously into the back of her mouth.
Oh God, this cannot be happening.
Come on, girl, she hears Jasmine's voice in the other room. We got 7 more minutes.
Nisha takes hold of the toilet brush and, looking away, starts to scrub vaguely at the inside of the bowl. She heaves twice, involuntarily, and has to pause to let her eyes stop watering. She allows herself a brief look down into the bowl. The brown mark is still there. She places the toilet brush against it and pushes, yelping involuntarily when water splashes upwards.
I will kill you, Carl, she says silently. I could just about forgive you the money and the stupid assistant, but I will never, ever forgive you for this.
Nisha gags again as she lifts the toilet seat and wipes it, then pauses and wipes her face. Her eyes are streaming. She has never hated humanity as much as she does in that moment, and for Nisha, that's saying something. She is 19-year-old Anita, just off a Greyhound bus at the Port Authority bus terminal, who blinked, gritty-eyed, at the towering buildings around her and asked for a job at the first place she came to, a narrow, grubby-looking 3-star hotel near 42nd Street. It had taken her 10 weeks of cleaning hotel rooms to get a better housekeeping job working for a wealthy family. 10 interminable weeks of disgusting bathrooms, leering male guests who decided to stay in their room while she cleaned, 10 weeks of bedbugs and stained linen and foul spillages and chemicals so strong they stripped all the moisture from her hands. After 18 months with the family, she got a job working reception at the Soho Gallery of a friend of that family, and the moment she had donned her anonymous uniform of black sweater and trousers and greeted the first slightly distracted customer, she had sworn she was never going to clean again. They do 11 more rooms in the next 2 hours. It is back-breaking work, lifting mattresses to make the beds, replacing furniture, why do guests move tables and armchairs, and vacuuming. There is a used condom in one room and blood-stained sheets in another. Both make her gag and her eyes water almost constantly.
People are animals, Jasmine mutters, ripping the undersheet from the mattress. They come in here, and from the moment they check in, it's like they turn into savages.
She harumps as she heads off to find a new protector. As Jasmine chats and occasionally hums alongside her, Nisha tells herself repeatedly, just to get through it, that this will soon be over. She thinks of the many ways in which she will make Carl pay, only a few of which involve a swift and merciful death. At 11, they are allowed a tea break and take their place in the tiny locker room where a heavily made-up receptionist called Tiffany and a bellboy sit and vape on the little wooden benches. Nearly everyone she meets smokes, either cigarettes outside or gulping thirstily from vapes. Nisha accepts a cigarette from the bellboy, grateful that the acrid smell of smoke briefly makes her forget the worst human scent she has just left behind.
You okay, Nisha? You gonna be quiet?
Jasmine refills her tea and hands it over to her.
I've not done this for a while.
You don't say?
Jasmine's laugh bursts into the room.
You're doing fine, babe. You're gonna have to speed up a little, but you're all good.
She looks up. Those nails ain't going to last long. I stopped getting normal manicures sometime around 2005. They've got to be armor-plated to survive this. Nisha looks down at her nails, the beautiful dark red edges now chipped from the endless scrubbing and rubbing, even with the latex gloves they are given. She can feel the sweat drying on her skin. Just a day, she thinks, and then she will work out how to get into the suite and never have to do this again. In the meantime, she finds herself listening to the workers' chat around her. Jasmine, she observes, is a life force, sunny and opinionated. She laughs often, as if almost everything is amusing, and although in normal life Nisha might have found this irritating, today she is grateful for it. She has had so little human contact in the last 48 hours that listening to normal conversation is almost pleasurable. The workers chat about bus routes, about cancelled benefits and dysfunctional families.
She says little, because what can she say? To these people, she is just Anita, another temporary worker who may or may not be here tomorrow. At lunchtime, which takes place at 2, they are given sandwiches by Alex, the man who is in the kitchen at breakfast. She had suspected they would be the same kind of cheap bread and filling that she has seen at the Tower Primavera, but they are beautiful soft sourdough bread filled with cheese, cured meats, and butterhead lettuce. He hands them over with exaggerated politesse, as if they are cherished guests. She would normally ask for salad, but she is so hungry after the morning's physical work that she just puts her head down and eats, taking huge, indelicate bites.
Alex says food is for the soul, so he ignores the management and does us the same he would for the guests, says Jasmine, chewing. I worship that man.
As she takes another huge, soft mouthful, Nisha thinks she probably worships him too.
Jasmine, when will we be doing the penthouse?
The penthouse? Oh, no, babes, they're picky up there, so it's got to be senior housekeepers like me. People the hotel knows they can rely on. Mind you, those assholes never tip. It's not a gig you want.
Nisha blinks and focuses extra hard on her sandwich. And then, at 6, as her lower back twinges and the ache in her shoulders switches from intermittent to a non-stop pulsing protest, the day is over. Jasmine calls her daughter, tells her she is on her way, asks her to tell Nana to leave her some stew, and hopes the buses will sort themselves out this evening. Her gait is a little wearier now, her laugh a little less ready. Nisha can barely move. She has pains in muscles she didn't know she had. She puts on the horrible jacket and sits slumped on the wooden bench, wondering how she'll pluck up the energy to walk back to the hotel. She'll get a taxi, she thinks, then remembers she has no cash for a taxi.
How far you got to go, babe?
Says Jasmine, who is checking her appearance in the small speckled mirror on the back of the door, reapplying lipstick with a connoisseur's slow, sure hand.
Tower Hill, she says.
Not too bad, though the highway is nuts this time of night, even on a Sunday. Alex lives over that way and sometimes it takes him an hour on the bus just to get that far.
I'm walking, she says.
The whole way. Good on you. That's why you're such a little bitty thing. See you tomorrow? Tomorrow. What is she going to do tomorrow? Her brain is so tired she can barely think.
Sure,
she answers because it's the easiest thing to do. Hang on, she says as Jasmine makes to leave.
What about my money?
Money?
For today?
Jasmine pulls a face.
You don't get paid by the day, babe. What do they do where you come from?
Agency and temp workers get paid at the end of the week. Just talk to Sandra and she'll sort it for you. I'm guessing you're cash in hand? She must have caught Nisha's look of horror because her face softens.
You really sure, huh?
Nisha nods dumbly. Jasmine stops and reaches into her bag. Nisha stares at her. She does not want to take money from this woman, with her catalogue quality jacket and cheap trainers. She does not want to think of herself as poorer than this. Jasmine gives her a steady look, as if assessing her, then pulls out £20 and holds it towards her.
I wouldn't normally do this, but I like you. You worked hard today. Make sure you get yourself something good to eat. If you haven't done this for a while, today would have taken it out of you.
Nisha takes the notes and stares at them. Jasmine lets out a small,
I'll see you tomorrow then, she says eventually, and smiles. I'm trusting you. And don't you come in smelling the cigarettes again, okay?
She hoists her bag over her shoulder and she is gone. Her phone already pressed to her ear, her free hand spraying clouds of the perfume around her shoulders. She tries the White Horse on Bailey Street before she goes back to the hotel. It is almost empty, just a handful of red-faced elderly men punctuating the corners, and the carpet sticks slightly to the soles of her feet. When she explains that she's looking for a missing pair of high-heeled shoes, the barman actually laughs in her face.
Chapter 11. Company gone into liquidation, closed until further notice. Sam looks at the sign, the gym bag slung over her shoulder, then peers through the glass door that has already been covered with newspaper, as if to stop the outside world looking in at a financial murder scene. A young man, his tanned, rippling arm muscles visible through his vest, even though the air is chilly, arrives beside her and lets out a loud curse.
I just joined,
he protests at Sam, as though it is her fault.
I just paid them a year in advance.
Sam watches him stride back across the car park, still cursing, wondering what she's supposed to do now about returning the bag to its owner. She feels briefly cross at the thought that she will now have to lug it to the office and home again afterwards and work out what on earth to do about it. This makes her think about Simon, no doubt checking his watch already, waiting to see if she is even a minute late to add to his checklist of things she has done wrong. She hauls the bag more tightly over her shoulder and heads for the tube station. There was a time, not that long ago, when Sam enjoyed her job. She didn't spring out of bed every morning whistling, or come home feeling like she had particularly added to the joy of the world, but there had been a quiet satisfaction in being with people whose company she enjoyed every day and knowing she could do the job she had done for 12 years pretty well. There were Sams in every office, the people who quietly and without drama kept everything running smoothly, willing to step in if extra hours were required, satisfied enough by what they did not to require ego stroking or excessive praise. She had received 3 salary increases in that time, none of which had been huge, but enough to make her feel like a valued member of staff. That had changed the day that Simon had arrived. He had stalked his way coldly around the offices of Greyside Print with thinly veiled disappointment, as if the desks themselves were a letdown. He had repeatedly interrupted Sam during her first meeting with him, and even shaken his head a couple of times while she was speaking, as if everything she said was in some way wrong. "You're going to have to explain more clearly what you mean, but why are you taking 10 days on jobs that could be done in 7? You're aware that Uber Print strives for excellence in every single job, and your boss was happy with the way you run things here, was he?" Everything he said seemed calculated to imply some deficit on her part, her attention levels, her schedules, even her punctuality. Sam was never late. At first, she tried to brazen it out. Joel told her not to take it personally. There was one like Simon wherever you went. "He's just dick-waving, babe, trying to make his mark." But the relentlessness of it had started to chip away at her so that she became all fingers and thumbs in his presence when trying to flick through her desk diary, or stammered preemptively, waiting for him to cut in over her in meetings. Now, as she left the house in the morning, a heavy, sickly feeling would settle in Sam's stomach. She had taken to listening to podcasts or ambient music on her journey to work, just so that she didn't have to think about what was likely to happen when she arrived. Every day when she walked in, Simon, visible in his glass-walled office, would look ostentatiously at the office clock and raise an eyebrow, even if she was 5 minutes early. He would text her late into the evening asking what had been done about improving the margins on the Carling job, or whether she had double-checked the pages weren't stuck together on the garden furniture catalogues. This had happened once while she was away on a week's holiday and Hardeep was meant to be covering, though this fact seemed irrelevant to Simon. It took her 2 months to realise that he never did it to the men. He would chat with them, his face wreathed in smiles, any suggestion that there was a problem covered with matey caveats, a suggestion that they could go for a drink later and sort it out. He would stand too close to the younger women, his hands half submerged at angles in his pockets, as if he were perennially pointing to his genitals, and smile and stare at their chests. Some, like Dee, would smile back and flirt with him, then bitch about him and the ladies. "That slimeball, he gives me the ick." But aside from Betty in accounts, who never spoke to anyone but had a mathematical brain that could work faster than a desk calculator, and Marina, who didn't give a monkey's what anybody thought about her, and would say as much without prompting, Sam was now the oldest woman in the office, and, Simon had apparently decided, not worthy of any attention that wasn't entirely negative in tone. It was exhausting. Once, she could have confided all this to Phil, and he would have calmed her, commiserated, offered strategies to help deal with it. She had mentioned it one evening after a particularly bad day, but instead of sitting her down and pouring her a glass of wine, he had put his head into his hands and told her he was sorry, he couldn't deal with anything else. She had been so alarmed at his apparent fragility that she had immediately reassured him it was nothing, nothing at all, just a bad day, and never mentioned it again. Ted, Joel, and Marina kept her going day to day, but nobody ever stepped in or stood up to Simon when he was haranguing her. Of course, Simon would save his most negative comments for when they were alone, or murmur them as he passed her cubicle. "Jesus, I don't know how you get any work done with a desk like that." Most of the time, if there was an audience, he would simply ignore her. But what could she do? With Phil out of work and their savings depleted, they were reliant on her salary. She kept her head down, did her best, ignored the ever-present knot in her stomach, and hoped that at some point he would grow bored and decide to pick on someone else.
Simon said it your way.
Marina puts a coffee on her desk furtively, like she's imparting classified information, and her expression as she turns away fills Sam with dread.
What now?
She says, but Marina has already gone. She slides the kit bag under her desk and hangs her handbag on the back of the chair, sits down, and logs onto her screen. He is there within seconds, wearing a pair of slightly too tight suit trousers and a belt with a high shine. His demeanour is that of a headmaster who has been dragged out of an important meeting to deal with a recalcitrant child.
Why did you not warn Fishers about the look of the colours on the uncoated paper?
I'm sorry? She turns too quickly and almost knocks her coffee from the table with her elbow.
4,000 copies of their new property brochure, and they're on the phone yelling because of the colour quality on the uncoated paper.
They said they wanted uncoated paper. They were keeping costs down. Ted and I did warn them it would look different from what they were used to. Simon pulls a face, as if there is no way this could be true.
Mark Fisher says you didn't tell them anything. Now he wants us to redo the whole job at cost. They say nobody is going to buy houses with everything looking so flat and colourless on the page.
I sat down with Mr. Fisher specifically at our last meeting and told him it would be a very different look. I showed him examples of the ClearSales catalogue. He dismissed it and said that would be fine.
So, Mr. Fisher is lying, is he?
Simon's voice is scornful.
He might be misremembering, but I remember it clearly. I even took notes. He said cutting costs was their main concern. It's not our fault, Simon, if he's changed his mind. Besides, it's the designer's job to communicate these things to the client. I only stepped in because I wasn't convinced they understood what they were asking for.
Well, Samantha, you stepping in has been pretty unhelpful because they are now convinced it's all Uberprint's responsibility, and you need to work out how you're going to put this mess right before it has very serious ramifications indeed.
He spins on his heel and is gone before she can protest. She has not even had time to take her coat off. She lets out a long sigh and slumps slightly in her chair. An email pings as she slides her left arm out of the sleeve, and she leans forward to open it. Chin up, babe. Don't let him get you down. Kiss. She looks up and over at Joel, whose face has appeared above the side of the logistics cubicle 10 feet away. When he smiles at her, she can't work out whether she wants to blush or burst into tears. At lunchtime, the builder, who has ignored Sam's increasingly frantic messages for the best part of 4 months, calls without warning and announces they will be starting work the following week on rebuilding the front wall, which had been irrevocably damaged in June by a pensioner no longer able to see their reversing mirrors. It's an insurance job, for which Sam breathes a sigh of relief. Who knew a small wall could be so expensive? She calls home while sitting in the staff eating area, one of the few places Simon never visits. He seems to see it as beneath him, with its carefully demarcated coffee mug ownership and microwave oven. She is eating a tuna and sweet corn sandwich made with 2-day-old bread. It is claggy in her mouth, or maybe today's altercation with Simon is making it feel like that.
Hi, love, she says, forcing brightness into her voice. How are you doing?
Okay, Phil says flatly. She can hear the burble of the television down the phone and pictures him, staring blankly at the overly made-up women discussing current affairs on the screen.
Well, Des Parry finally got back to me. They're going to start work on the wall Monday, finally, so you'll need to move the camper van.
The camper van? To where?
I don't know. Onto the road?
But it's got no tax.
Well, we'll have to tax it. He can't get to the wall if it's parked where it is. Or maybe one of your friends with a garage could look after it.
Oh, I don't think I can ask the boys. She closes her eyes for a moment. We haven't really spoken in a while. It would feel... His voice tails away.
Phil, love, we need to move the van, whatever. It would be great if you could work out how to do that. I'm pretty stretched here.
There is a long pause. Can't we put them off for a bit? I don't think I'm up to that right now. It is then that she feels the anger boil up inside her.
Up to what? Moving a van 6 feet?
The whole tax and MOT thing, and I don't know where we would put it. I can't really handle it right now.
Well, you'll have to work something out because the builder is coming.
Just put him off a week. I'll think about it.
No, Phil!
She can hear her voice becoming high and shrill.
I will not put him off. It's taken me months to get him in the first place, and I can't risk him going to another job. And that wall is dangerous. You know it is. If someone climbs on it and it collapses, they'll be seriously hurt, and we'll be liable. So just sort out the bloody van and move it. Then we can both get on with our lives, okay?
There is a long silence on the other end of the phone. You don't have to be aggressive about it, he says grimly. I'm doing my best.
Are you, though? Are you really?
Something has unlocked in Sam, and she can't help it. Words pour out of her mouth like hard pebbles.
I'm working flat out and running the house and trying to look after Andrew and Kat and the incontinent dog and dealing with bloody Simon, and you were lying on your ass on the sofa for 16 hours a day and in bed the other 6. When did you last do a supermarket shop or walk Kevin or sweep the kitchen floor or anything at all other than feel sorry for yourself? You're not doing anything, just wallowing. You do nothing but wallow.
Silence. And then he says, 8. It's 8 hours in bed.
What?
There are 24 hours in a day. 16 hours on the sofa. That leaves 8.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Phil! You know what I'm saying. Just do something, okay? I know you're sad, and I know you feel like life is hard, and it is. My God, I know it is. But sometimes you just have to get up and bloody get on with it. That's exactly what I've been doing for months, and I can't do it on my own anymore, okay? I just can't.
This time she doesn't wait to see how he will respond. She ends the call and stares at the wall, her heart pounding in her chest. It is then that she turns and jumps at Simon standing in the doorway.
Dealing with bloody Simon, he says slowly, nodding, a peculiar half-smile on his face. Interesting. I was just coming to tell you that you need to renegotiate the figures on the Bilson job. Head office says the margins aren't good enough.
Sam stares as he turns and walks away. She looks at the cling film wrapped sandwich on her lap, her blood pumping in her ears, and without even really knowing what she's doing, she hurls it across the room so that it explodes soggily against the wall. 7 minutes later, Sam straightens her jacket, gets up, and using squares of kitchen towel, picks up every bit of sweet corn from the carpet, wipes the mayo and butter from the wall with a damp cloth, then puts the whole thing carefully into the bin.